Can be hard to believe it's been 10 years since the Affordable Care Act passed Congress, providing health insurance coverage to most people and setting up a political battle that continues to this day. The ACA, Obamacare if you prefer, didn't get everyone covered. Our guest this hour wants to see that happen and thinks women can take center stage in making it happen. Rosemarie Day is the author of Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Health Care. Rosemarie Day has 2 decades of experience in this area. She was the chief operating officer at the Massachusetts Medicaid program, and played a part in the launch of the first state-run health insurance exchange in Massachusetts. She's the founder and CEO of Day Health Strategies. Rosemarie Day, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
You write of joining other women in marching and fuming about health care. Did the 2017 Women's March seal the deal for you?
Well, the deal opened up when Donald Trump was elected and said that his goal on day one was to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and I felt like the odds were pretty high that he'd be able to do that given the Republican leadership stance at that time as well. So that was the opening salvo, but the Women's March the day after the inauguration in January 2017 was something I will never forget. It was so powerful to be a part of that huge, peaceful protest. And people had a lot of different signs they were holding, but many of them were about healthcare, about protecting the ACA, and about making healthcare a right. And that got me to thinking, as folks said, okay, we marched, what's next? And feeling that power of coming together and what we could do if we really galvanized more people was what started percolating in my mind. So yes, my book was my answer to the what's next. Other people decided to run for office, you know, and did some great things, and we've seen the effects of that. But yes, I wrote this book.
You gave me a bit of an aha moment early in the book, though, in talking about that time and pointing out that you know it gets trickier when you have the sign that says let's do this. That's once you begin to get past what you can fit on a sign, it gets a lot harder to develop answers to the problems. Easy to describe the problems, not so great for the answers.
Right. Yes. And as somebody once said, you know, healthcare is complicated.
Right.
Yes. So I tried to simplify it, in the book to make this really accessible for people to understand the basics. And then, I was advised, please don't just write a book about the problems. Everyone's tired of hearing about the problems. Please tell us what we can do. So I really tried to make that a huge emphasis in the book. And I'm a really strong believer in our democracy and in the activism that keeps fueling people to engage.
So let me back up to a really broad point, though, which is what do you see as being at the heart of the resistance to getting everyone covered?
You know, on one level, it's really actually hard to understand because when you survey people, over 90% of folks will say healthcare should be a right in this country. But when you start to ask the follow-up questions, that's where things start to fall apart a little bit and you lose some of the support for the concept. And really one of the things that people will feel threatened by is if they think, quote-unquote, the government's going to take over my health care. So, you know, about half the population is insured through their employer. Some people are really well insured, other people very skimpy insurance. It's a huge range. But nonetheless, that's about half of our population. And so a lot of folks who, the insurance they know is what they would prefer until they can feel really comfortable with what an alternative might be. So coming out of the gate, a government alternative is not something people will necessarily go flocking to. So if they think that the solution to make healthcare a right, the only solution is Medicare for all, for example, you lose support as you continue to ask people these questions because they don't necessarily want to give up what they have. They want to make sure that there's coverage should they need it, should they lose that job. And my goodness, with the pandemic, that's even more evident. But the element of choice and trying to keep the government at bay to a certain extent is a really important driver of this conversation.
Tell us about John Rawls and his veil of ignorance concept.
Okay. So I went back to some of the stuff I studied actually in college and grad school, which to think about how you build a society that truly does have equality wrapped up in it. One of the thought experiments that you do is you say, if I were born and didn't know what status, you know, what class level or what race or gender I would be, I knew none of that. There was this veil of ignorance. How would I design the society? Because if I don't know, you know, how well off I'm going to be, what would I want to make sure the society offers me or that I can partake of that would be fair? And then when your class is revealed, you know, then, you know, you take what you get whatever. But you would, what guides people to is this sense of wanting to have some basic level of needs being met, kind of no matter what. Because if you don't know what station you're going to be born into, you actually would prefer to have something that's more fair than, frankly, what we have today.
Well, and we're about a minute away from a break, but you're right. In the case of healthcare, the free market doesn't work. It fails spectacularly. Where's the major breakdown?
Well, I think the major breakdown is that we still have over 30 million people uninsured in this country. And so for a country that is so wealthy and has advanced technology and healthcare solutions so rapidly, we are leaving way too many people out, which means our country's overall mortality rates are higher than other wealthy countries, and other kinds of measures of our collective health are lower than other countries have achieved, and that's because we're leaving people out of the coverage landscape.
Rosemary, how central have women been to pushes for health care in the past?
A lot of times they've played a behind-the-scenes role, and that's been a classic element of activism, including, you know, even in the civil rights movement. We saw are now learning about a number of the women, the African-American women, who were playing very strong roles but didn't have, the lead microphone in the effort. So we've seen that women have led from where they are and tried to find solutions if they felt that, garment workers in the factories needed health care. They would open up a clinic, back in the early part of the 1900s, they would open up a clinic in the factory and just kind of take matters into their own hands and solve it there right on the ground level. But when we look at the movement for universal health care, it certainly has had a number of leaders who've been men, and I have no problem with that, and certainly Barack Obama gets a ton of credit for the Affordable Care Act, but so should Nancy Pelosi, because she's the person who got it through Congress, and you need both branches to make that happen. What I'm really trying to point out is that to make this final push for universal health care, we are going to need the pressure to come from the grassroots level for enough people to say across the aisle, and I'd really love for this to be bipartisan, for enough people to say, we want a change. We think our country should cover everybody because all the other wealthy countries have done it. And especially when we're in this pandemic, it just cries out for the solution. And not to overburden women, because I recognize we already have so much on our plates, but the point is it's actually to make it easier for us, because if we're worrying about how we're going to cover our health care costs, how we're going to cover our families, we can't solve that individually. This is where the personal is political, and I want to encourage women to step up into the collective power that we can have to push the political system to get to the right answer on this.
And there's a number we haven't given yet, but what percentage of decisions about health care for a family, women do how many?
They're making 80% of the decisions and have been dubbed the chief medical officer of their homes, which sounds like a fancy title. In the business world, it is, and it comes with power. What I'm suggesting is we've got this gap, between what we're having to manage and struggle to manage at the home front level and what's actually happening in terms of our political priorities at the national level.
Our guest again, Rosemary Day, the author of Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Coverage. So not going backwards, you say employer-sponsored coverage, your charts indicate about 49% of the country covered that way. Not the answer to go back to that. Why?
Well, as we're seeing with the pandemic, if you lose your job, you lose your health care coverage. And fortunately, we do have the Affordable Care Act in place still today, tenuous as it may be. And so that has provided a safety net for people who've lost jobs. There is a place they can go to their health insurance exchange and get coverage, or if they're low income enough, they can qualify for Medicaid. So that's really been incredibly helpful. But even before the pandemic, we were seeing an erosion of the benefits in the employer-sponsored health insurance world, and that a lot of small and mid-sized companies were struggling to actually even continue offering the coverage. If they did offer it, they had to offer increasingly high deductible plans and things like that that put more of the burden of the costs onto their employees. So we were seeing this erosion, and now with the pandemic, the job loss is going to translate into at least 5 million, maybe 10 million more uninsured people on top of the 30 million already uninsured. So that is absolutely moving in the wrong direction, and the companies aren't going to have the wherewithal, should they be able to regain their footing or come back into business. They're going to struggle to be able to offer these expensive benefits. And so we have to find another solution.
So a couple of things about the Affordable Care Act and its effect on health and health costs in the country. First of all, since you have extensive experience and do live in Massachusetts and work there, how different was the ACA from its Massachusetts ancestor?
So the framework was the same. Overall, in that there was, created this notion of a health insurance exchange that government would run and would be vetting all the private insurance to make sure that good quality insurance would be sold in an online platform. So we have that nationally with healthcare.gov, and we have it state by state as well. And some states are running their own exchanges. So that was the same as what we did in Massachusetts. There was also a system of subsidies put in place so that people who are working at, low to middle income would be able to afford the insurance. If they don't get it through their employer, they could get it through the exchange, and there would be like a discount. This subsidy would help them cover the cost. So that was also the same idea. Massachusetts, however, has had a more generous subsidy framework, and they were unable to accomplish that in passing the ACA. So the subsidies are not as robust. We also had the other leg of the stool, if you will, the three-legged stool here, was the individual mandate penalty. And so there was this requirement to buy insurance, and then they're penalized through your taxes if you don't. So that was also started in Massachusetts and then was continued on at the federal level until that was repealed. So those core elements of the framework are the same, but the piece that's really, really important for folks is that subsidy piece, and that was not as robust. And so that's where we need to do better in terms of, making the Affordable Care Act, frankly, making the healthcare more affordable, and that's something that has actually been proposed by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
And how much bigger would the subsidies have to be, do you think, to get near universal coverage?
In Massachusetts, we got to just about 2% uninsured. At our peak, we before the pandemic and stuff, we were 2%, maybe 3% uninsured, and I would call that near universal coverage. So basically having a subsidy structure more like that, it's really hard to say dollar for dollar what that would need to be, because it all depends on your income level and the cost of the insurance you're buying.
So is it a percentage of income or an income cutoff line? I mean, what are some of the levers that you think would be best manipulated there?
I think looking at the percentage of income would, so that it truly could be a call it a sliding scale, but one that doesn't just have like a cliff, when you get to your income being 400% of the federal poverty level, that it would continue to move up the income scale and reduced amount of subsidy, but that it would have a glide path that doesn't have that sharp cliff.
All right, so no big fat cutoff, that would help. Now, as far as medical costs, you hang around social media enough, you see people say, well, everything costs more now because of Obamacare. So what happened there? Why do medical procedures seem to continue to go up and up and defy gravity?
Okay, so there's kind of two things wrapped up in there. So one is that Obamacare, or Affordable Care Act, whichever you want to call it, did actually require people to buy insurance that was more robust, because there had been a lot of skimpy insurance that was sold, and then people would find out when they actually got sick or went to the hospital that their expenses weren't covered, and then would be shocked and dismayed to realize that the fine print had said that and they hadn't read the fine print. So under the Affordable Care Act, the idea was to only let people buy that kind of insurance for maybe 2 or 3 months at a time, and instead be selling the annual kind of insurance in a more robust way, which did for some people raise the cost. However, that was offset by the subsidies. So there was some grumbling about the insurance getting more expensive, and there was an adjustment that had to be made at that initial time. But it meant real insurance was what was being sold, something that covers you no matter what. And that was the key, right? So anyway, and that is how we are able to cover people with pre-existing conditions and all of the good things that were wrapped up into that. So there was some added expense at that time. The cost of insurance goes up each year because, as you point out, the cost of medical procedures keeps going up, and that's really the driver of it. The insurance companies tend to reflect what costs they're being told will have to be absorbed, and that's coming out of hospitals and doctors and the procedures and the medications and all the things, that ways in which we get treated in the healthcare system. That has to be paid for. And those costs have been marching up year after year. There has been a reduction in the rate of increase, actually, since the Affordable Care Act passed, interestingly. But every year, the costs tend to go up at a rate higher than just typical inflation, and that's really hard to keep up with. So why do those costs go up? There are a lot of contributing factors, but as we chase new and better treatments and procedures and technology, all of those investments have to get paid for somehow. We tend to pay more for every procedure than they do in other countries. And some of that's because our doctors are paid more, not primary care physicians, but our specialists are paid more than they are in other countries. There's a lot of different drivers to our cost structure. We also have a pretty robust for-profit element, woven throughout our medical system, and that's a controversial issue. But certainly it plays out in the pharmacy benefit side and some of the really high prices that we're paying there.
Rosemary Day is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, has been working for several decades now in health insurance and health coverage issues, and wants to get everybody covered in the United States, thinks women can lead the way. The book she's written is called Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Healthcare. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. First call from Phil in Eureka. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, hi. I guess we live in an age of irony because, to my knowledge, I just recently really became conscious of this, is that all the congressmen, the senators and congressmen and the Supreme Court justices, all of them are covered by a federal medical plan. Apparently, I'm told they're even covered after they retire. And it seems to me that kind of information would be wonderful for the general public to know about as they contend with the fact that they can't afford to buy medical coverage. So I would say that, well, perhaps most of those people in Congress are millionaires anyway, then they would be on the forefront to abandon the federal coverage that they have and buy their own. Anyway, maybe you could educate me more about, well, who's covered in the federal government.
All right. Great question, Phil. Thanks for that.
No, you are absolutely right. And in fact, in the height of the heated efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, a story came out about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who had almost had a heart attack, and because of the great health care that he gets, in fact, there's like a doctor, I think, that is like underneath the Senate floor, so if anything looks like an emergency, a senator can be rushed down and be looked at immediately. Well, apparently something like that happened, and they said, Mitch, you have to go directly to the hospital, and I think he had like quadruple bypass heart surgery or something. But had he been a regular person just out, you know, on the street or on a job, regular job, probably wouldn't have gotten as immediate of attention. And what made me heartsick about this was that he was one of the ones who was vociferously working to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and he had benefited from our taxpayer-funded really good insurance that the senators, the members of Congress, the president, we just saw President Trump was treated very well for his coronavirus episode. And the rest of us don't have that kind of coverage. So there is a real irony there, to say the least.
Let's take another call from Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I really hope that your efforts are successful. My question is, why are Republican politicians trying to destroy the ACA in the middle of a pandemic where 250,000 people have already died? Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate that.
So, interestingly, in this election, they were not running on repealing the Affordable Care Act, not overtly. They were actually saying they want to protect people with pre-existing conditions, which is a 180-degree turn from where they were 4 years ago. So we have made some progress. The problem is that the rhetoric isn't matching the reality, and that we know there's that case before the Supreme Court where the Trump administration is arguing to overturn the Affordable Care Act. I'm just telling you more about what is. Do I totally understand the hearts and minds of some of the Republican leadership and how, frankly, I think it can be so hateful to be trying to repeal something during a pandemic? I can't completely answer that, to be honest. I do think that there was a period of time where basically doing anything that was the opposite of what President Obama did seemed to be what was carrying the day, certainly for Trump and for Senator McConnell. I hope that is going to change. Certainly we will have new presidential leadership. And that I would love, as I say, I would love to see some bipartisanship on this. We saw that in Massachusetts, and we have a Republican governor who continues to uphold the original Massachusetts law and has stayed committed to it. You know, so it is. There are some Republicans who do that, and I would like to see more of them step up and be courageous. And I feel like women can push the Republican Party to do more of that on that side of the aisle. That's where we actually see a dichotomy of like voting preferences, more so than on the Democratic side of the aisle, where men and women are more aligned and where they prioritize health care. But the health care vote is definitely more female-led on the Republican side.
There's at least a portion of the country that we've learned in previous conversations that is adamant about not giving free stuff, so-called, to people, and would rather not have it themselves than have it offered to people they see as undeserving. I have to believe that's been shrinking over the 10 years since the ACA was passed.
It has been shrinking. You know, there is that dynamic, and it's a very unfortunate one. But if you look at the states, for example, that have not yet expanded the Medicaid program, which turned out to be kind of a bellwether of this, the Affordable Care Act allowed states to raise, with actually 100% federal funding, states could go in and raise the income cutoff from really, really low to moderately low income to qualify for Medicaid. And there are 12 states that have not yet done that. And the good news is that two states this past year, through ballot initiative, voted to raise that standard and bring it up to the level that was envisioned by the Affordable Care Act. And that those states are Missouri and Oklahoma.
We're both very red states now, so it's rather surprising to see that happen, yeah.
But honestly, the pandemic probably helped here as people were losing jobs and also rural hospitals closing. It starts to, people realize, oh no, this is us. This is us who was getting hurt by this, and we need to turn that around. sad thing is that most of the remaining states that have not yet expanded Medicaid are in the South and are facing real pain from the pandemic.
So how many people are still uninsured and why?
We don't have an official count since we've been hit with this pandemic, so those are just estimates. The official count was at about 30 million pre-pandemic, and as I said, we're expecting another 5 to 10 million people to lose their insurance and not be able to find a replacement. So that'll take us up to potentially 40 million people.
And why so many children? Because there are specific programs designed to keep children in health insurance protection.
Yeah, we have about 4 million uninsured kids in our country, which is really a travesty and should not happen. There is a program called the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is supposed to help families who maybe make a little too much money for qualifying for Medicaid. A lot of families don't know about it, don't sign up. Families who are immigrants that may have the appropriate immigration status, but there's the chilling effect of reaching out for any kind of government benefit, particularly in the Trump era. So people who are legitimately eligible won't apply. So there's a lot of outreach and education that has to continually be done. And I argue in the book that we really ought to think about just automatic enrollment for kids at birth in some basic health plan that then parents can opt out of if they want, but then we wouldn't be chasing down folks to try and get them covered.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. It's sort of like getting your voter registration when you get your driver's license.
That or, another point I make in the book is we do agree as a country that K-12 education should be a right. Mm-hmm. You know, every kid gets educated. So why can't we do that for health insurance? For them, it's for us as a society, that's very inexpensive.
Let's take another call. We have Donna in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rosemarie Day.
Did you say Donna?
I did.
Repeat. I want to follow up on the politicians and government employees that get health care that the rest of the people pay taxes for. Most people aren't really aware and they don't hear. And some simple message to politician, give me what you've got, give you what I've got as a spousal. Or if I had family that got it also. That's all I want to say. There's not enough attention to some of the basics, so we can't hear a politician put it down when he's signed up for it. And his policies, I'm so nervous, his policies are probably better than what the federal employees get, which other people pay for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Donna, thanks. You did great. Appreciate you calling into the exchange. So the idea that there are great healthcare policies out there, even federal employees have them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. An interesting little side note on the Affordable Care Act was that originally members of Congress and their staff were supposed to get their insurance through the D.C. Health Insurance Exchange. So that was meant to make it pretty important that the exchanges would be launched well and be functioning well, because the folks who wrote the law would have skin in the game, as it were.
So I want to point out, before we get into the specifics that for women here, that you do point out it's more than health insurance. There are other things we need to take into account in our society more broadly.
Yes, absolutely. And this has been getting a lot of attention during the pandemic, but what's known as the social determinants of health, so what's the quality of your housing, of your food supply, of the education that's available to you, all of these other things that are correlated with your socioeconomic status. Those are things that also drive what your health looks like. So are you consigned to being in a neighborhood that's right next to, a heavily polluted area, toxic waste dump, that kind of thing? That's going to affect your health a lot. So I wrote a book about getting more people health insurance coverage because I see that as very necessary to get to good health, but it is not sufficient. So I devoted a chapter to these social determinants. And one of the determinants is also racism, and that has come to the fore this year, particularly with the murder of George Floyd and the disparities in the pandemic health outcomes, all of those things are bringing a lot more attention to the inequities that we have and the devastating impact of racism on people's health.
We have another question from a listener. Vince dropped off his question. Wanted to thank you and agree with you. His mother did have complete control of the medical situation in his house growing up, but he brings it back to coverage for members of Congress. Wants to know, for women, especially in Congress, does their health care also branch out to their families? Does a spouse of a Congress member get the coverage and the kids too?
I know that family coverage is available. What I don't know off the top of my head is how much they have to pay toward that, you know, whether it's fully covered or they've got to contribute that that piece. I don't know.
Okay. So now let's talk about energizing women to move ahead. I mean, but we run a risk here, don't we, about, you know, seeing something monolithic here, like seeing any group of people as all feeling the same way?
Oh, of course. And I would never, claim. Women is certainly a very broad category, but I was very struck by, you know, in the research I did and looking at the voting patterns. It does tie back, as I said, to the personal is political, and that across party lines, we as women are contending with a lot of the very same issues and dynamics of caregiving and the responsibilities that come with that. And so I wanted to make that appeal to people across party lines, and there's a huge number of folks in our country who aren't tied to one party or the other. They're registered as independents, and I wanted to make the case to them as well. So it doesn't mean that we're all going to feel the same way, but I'm reacting to the fact that our place in life seems to be, that we have a lot of similar experiences. And I was reminded of that during the Me Too movement that also broke out in 2017 not that it hadn't existed before, but the actual kind of huge amount of attention put a lot of women in the same boat in terms of how we've been treated, in the workplace, et cetera. And so there is some common element, whether people want to identify with that or not. I wanted to call upon people to say, let's not feel like we're victims. Let's come together collectively, as we did at the Women's March, and push forward a positive agenda. And I'd say that should come from grassroots, but it's got to move right on up the line. So I encourage people to step up their activism from wherever they are, but that could mean you're somebody who would actually consider running for office, or you're someone who would help someone run for office who's going to campaign on a universal health care message, or you're brave enough to tell your story at a town hall meeting to defend the Affordable Care Act because you have a pre-existing condition. So many women have stepped up in that way, and I want to take that to that next level.
And it's not a big part of the book, but you had your own family health care issues, including your own in 2017. So you got 2020 3 years early.
Yeah, I've said I thought 2017 was bad until I got to 2020. But, that was kind of the last straw, I think, was going through so many health events and realizing, on the one hand, how incredibly fortunate I was that I had good health insurance coverage, because it was hard enough to go through cancer with having really great coverage and not having to worry about that. What I kept thinking about is, what about the people who have really high deductibles or no insurance at all? What on earth would they be doing right now? And it was a source of anguish, and I just thought, also right when everybody was trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and I thought, if I get through this to the other side, I've got to do something more, and that, again, led to this book.
All right, so what form are we looking at here? What are the things that you're advocating for, or are you very open-minded about that? Because, we certainly heard during the presidential campaign, Medicare for all who want it, Medicare down to age 60, Medicare down to age 50, and then a lot of options that didn't include Medicare at all. Joe Biden has talked about including a public option along with the ACA. Mm-hmm. But given the people who got elected in 2020, what do you think is possible versus what is desirable?
So I will always say what's desirable is making healthcare a right in this country, and that's where we are all on the same page, including folks who are advocating for Medicare for all. But I don't think Medicare for all is the way to get there, and certainly with the outcome of this election, some of which is still yet to be fully determined what the Senate's going to look like. Mm-hmm. But even if the Senate were to go all Democratic, it's not going to be like some wildly blue wave form of Democratic. So the idea of Medicare for all at this point in time, I believe, is a bridge too far. So I was trying to put forth some other models in the book that could still get us to the goal, but would be more, as I say, digestible to the American public. And so I'm a fan of several different paths. I don't necessarily prescribe one exact proposal. I say we need a I put out some principles. They look a lot like what Biden-Harris have included. I don't necessarily say it has to be the public option, but that notion of for those who want it, so you said Medicare for those who want it, there has to be the element of choice, and we have to have a hybrid of a public and private sector solution. That's how I see the path to getting there. And other countries have done it that way. Americans aren't as familiar with what countries other than England and Canada have done, so I put in the book information about Germany, I take as an example, that has found another path.
And do they keep the private insurance companies involved, as mm-hmm. we have done?
Yes, mm-hmm. and Switzerland does, and many countries have kept the private sector involved quite strongly. But they also make sure that everyone is going to get coverage, and that these government guardrails are there so that the private sector isn't just operating in an unfettered way.
Now, does COVID, it certainly has illuminated things a bit more. Does it provide some opportunities to get this discussed more, believed in more? Does the fact that we've actually passed a couple of relief bills that are into the trillions make some of the costs we're talking about somewhat easier to stomach?
That's a double-edged sword, because there will be those who say, well, now that we've had to do all this COVID relief, we won't have the money, mm-hmm. For universal health care. I still think that we can find the money, and that the pandemic shows us we can't afford not to. So first we have to get through this most immediate crisis, and the surge that we're in is quite scary. And so that's going to take full attention. Getting the vaccine, out there and getting people to take it, it's going to take several more months. And so it won't really be until we're into 2021 that I think we can say, okay, and now what do we do, to gird ourselves against something like this happening in our future? Because I'm afraid it won't be just a once-in-a-century event, unfortunately. So how are we better prepared next time? And I think that's going to be the task of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris once we get through this crisis, is to make sure we're ready for the next time, and that includes having people have full health insurance coverage. Universal health care, I think, will be very much an agenda item that we not only should be pushing for, but I think they'll have at the top of the agenda, because that's how we'll be prepared for next time.
I got time for one more question, and it's you saying late in the book, at this point you may be wondering, am I really an activist? How should people answer that?
Well, I have a website, rosemaryday.com, where you can go and take a quick quiz and gauge what level of activist you are. And then what I encourage you to do, and I give you tips and links and stuff, is to take a step, one step out of your comfort zone and move towards another level of activism. And so no judgment about what level you're at. Just want to kind of assess where you are and then give you some tips and tools to move on up that ladder.
Rosemary Day has extensive coverage in this area, was once the chief operating officer at the Massachusetts Medicaid program, and also played a similar role in the launch of the first state-run health insurance exchange. Her book is Marching Toward Coverage, How Women Can Lead the Fight for Universal Health Care. Rosemary, thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.